Welcome to Photography Insights, the show that interviews people from the photography world. I'm your host, Andrew Walmsley, and today we have an intellectual and thought-provoking photographer for you. Dima Gavrish started life in Ukraine, is now living and working in the USA near the Silicon Valley. A man who has two master degrees in cinematography from Kiev and photography. He's a well-travelled man who has worked as a freelance photojournalist for Associated Press. I first came across Dima's work through LensCratch because of his role in Afghanistan. He tells us about important moments in his career, like during 9/11, he was scanning in a newsroom and seeing what happened to him on the news made him move to New York. Dima ended up at the Washington Post. After time, he realized this had no meaning and saw the never-ending war of Afghanistan in the news. That was the catalyst and volunteered to go over. Dima talks to us about getting to know soldiers and the experience of them not coming back again. The realities of war are boredom, anticipation, and fear. His take from his time over there was that he found lots of things about himself, but he had more questions than answers. And from his work in Afghanistan, he's created a book about this project called Inshallah, which means God willing, and is available on Amazon. And obviously, I'll put a link in the show notes to you for that one. So in this one, we are going to discuss technology is not important. He's destined to be a doctor. What education did for him? Introductions were key, restrictions of shooting, short form versus long form news, Prince Charles and President Obama, meeting Afghan elders, press and the military, being macho, the tech industry, iPhone shooting, and the importance of reading. And before I move you on to the show, I'd obviously always like to thank the friends, which are Film Dev, Chroma Camera, and Lacoste Static Age. Please don't forget that my Ko-fi donation page is now up and live, so anyone who wants to help fund improvements to the equipment and things I test, please do check that out. You can donate any small amount, and it's not a regular thing, it's literally just something you can just do as a one-off. So please do check that out. Now, recently, I've been looking at a feed on Instagram called F8 Documentary. It's like a hub of a few different photographers, and they've been doing like a bi-monthly zine. Unfortunately, so far I've been unable to get the zine in time before it sells out. But this month, I jumped on the bandwagon early and got myself a copy. And I did say to David, who I've been following more than anyone, so that's David Gilbert Wright, he asked for my thoughts. Now, I thought instead of sending them personally over to him, I thought I'd talk about it on here, so he can have a public response to it. Hopefully I'll get a review of a few of these things together at some point, and we might do a one-off show anyway. But anyway, David's work in the zine is basically all about the 1970s and the Asians migrating into the UK. And specifically, he's talking about a place called Brick Lane in London. Now, my geography of London is not great. I don't know how it affected it. So it was quite nice to read what went on in that area compared to like where I lived. And it actually looks like the same place I grew up in, to be honest. So there's some interesting photos here by David of shopkeepers, and he's got a picture here of a family, and as he puts in his comments about the photo, you've got a nice traditional Asian lady wearing normal Asian clothing, and then you've got a child who's wearing probably more westernized children's clothes, and then the husband wearing a suit, which could be, from any place, anywhere, really. So I think it highlights a little bit of the change and westernisation of their cultures mixing with ours. But it's quite heartbreaking in places, in the sense, it was a big thing in the UK in the 70s where making these steps towards everybody working with each other and us children living amongst new people, because I was one of them. I was a child in the 70s. I attended a school in the middle of where the Asian community lived, so my school photos show a good mixture of both English, traditional white British, and some Asian families, and they were friends of mine as well. And it was an interesting mix of cultures and thoughts, religions, everything. Food, I mean, food was probably one of the biggest things at that time, to be honest, because there were so many new flavors and spices and smells around, and it was a big thing to traditional UK families that weren't used to all this, and there was, some horrendous things going on at the time, and there was so much trouble with the culture side. And I remember this, we were all part of it, we all went through it, and I think David's captured it quite well in his photos here, and I appreciate it's not a massive zine as such, he's dedicated, I think it was about 10, 12 pages to his little story. So I'm sure at some point we'll see a bigger body of work from David on this. But you'll see him all over Instagram. He's popping up all over on different feeds and articles and interviews, etc. He's been out there for decades shooting film. So I think it's really nice. And these are just traditional shots from the 70s. There's three guys stood on a street. Looks like the bartering or some sort of business deal. And yeah, that's what he did. You didn't need telephones. You could just go stand out and make a deal in them days. It was a different world. So what's my thoughts, David? I think it's great. I think it's a very different sort of zine as well, because it's unusual to have so much text, which is really good because obviously it complements the images and explains why you've chosen them. So hats off to yourself for your photography, and obviously Fistful of Books and Simon for putting the work out there. I think it does some great things here. So yeah, really love it. Keep up the good work, mate, and we'll see what you do in the future. Before I move you over into the interview, please don't forget there are some images on the website, of course, to complement the podcast, and they will relate to some of the things we've discussed. And obviously, there'll be a link to Dima's website. And if anyone's interested in the book, there's a link there. It's not an affiliate link, it's just an Amazon link. So, yeah, I hope you do check him out. Very nice guy, very, very thoughtful, and it's a really thought-provoking guy and what his work means to him. So I hope you do enjoy this, and let's play the music. I was having a conversation with someone earlier this week about like Fujifilm. Fujifilm make no money off cameras. They only make money off Instax because they sell tons and tons of them. And it's like, it's a strange thing to me, things like that. Why is it like that?
Well, I have no idea. Honestly, I think that well, Instax is it's a curiosity, I would say. It's a curiosity from the generation from that never held anything in their hands besides the phone, besides the smartphone. So in that regard, like why everybody is just, this hipster thing, oh, I'm shooting film. Who gives a shit what you use to capture? Like no one ever asked Jim Nachtwey or Elliot Erwitt or me or I don't know, you name it, like anybody who's somebody, like what camera do you, this is the question that everybody hates, because no one cares what equipment to use. Of course, when you look at the work by Richard Mosse, and you see those amazing landscapes from Africa, but he very smartly used the technology, the film, to underpin the idea, the concept of his work. So it's not the medium that dictates the idea, it's the idea that dictates the medium, and that's a crucial thing. So who cares if you use Mac or PC, as long as it gets you where you need to get, that's it. So this is just basic curiosity. Like, imagine we just see, I don't know, I would draw parallel to the way we look at SpaceX. Oh my God, look at that stuff. It flies. Wow. Same thing with film in new generation. So people see film, people are captivated by the magic of film. Magic. Because, oh my God, you do something with your hands. It doesn't happen on the screen. It's physical. So it's much more material, I would say. So it's just that. Because in the end, no one cares what tools were used in, capturing of certain image. I mean, unless it's definitely underpins the entire concept. So
Thanks.
that's the way I would put it.
I agree. Because some art is about using, sometimes it's even about using a particular technology to make something into it. Like, let's say, for instance, some of the artists I've spoken to can only make an image using this form of camera because it's the only camera that will see that light spectrum, for instance. So it's just having the right equipment, isn't it?
So I would like to put the issue of equipment to rest, because in the end, when you open an app on your phone, do you really care what laptop has been used in the coding of this app? Do you care if it's designed in Figma or in Sketch or Adobe XD or whatever? Like, do you really care? You care about the design in the higher sense of this word. So it doesn't just look pretty, that it actually works. And does it get the job done? That's what you care about as an end user, and that's the way it should be. When you go into a gallery and you see some photograph on a wall, how it's been done, how it's made, it's not the first question that you ask. It's somewhere way down the line, like, oh, by the way, just curious. I think that's the appropriate way to treat this question.
That's good. And obviously, one of the main reasons for getting you on here was that some of your work is outstanding. It's so interesting.
Thank you.
But it was really interesting to hear you actually have two masters as well. You're very greedy. So, and the different other. So obviously you started in Kiev with your cinematography. So what did you really like about the
Sorry, yeah.
cinematography?
It was 1995. The Soviet Union collapsed. Basically, nothing. People were just going nearly hungry. So it's my whole family has medical background. I was supposed to be a doctor in fourth generation, pretty high profile, but again, my parents weren't getting their salary for like 8 or 9 months in a row. And I was 18. And at some point I was basically, okay, I graduated from high school and the decision has to be made what to do next. And I decided that, well, I saw how my sister was getting her degree in medicine, and she went to medical school. And I was like, no, guys, you can just shoot me now. I'm not doing this. Like, it's just too much. I'm not that kind of person. So what I did is I was always fascinated with the visual stuff, with imagery, with technology, how that creates it and whatnot. So I decided to get into the National Cinema Academy of Ukraine. It's better to say it this way because the real name is atrociously long and indiscernible in English. So I'm just going to leave it at that. it's the Karpenko Karov Institute, in short. So anyway, I was always fascinated with cameras and, you know, that initial youngster zest of, oh my God, look at this thing. It makes pictures, it clicks, it looks cool and whatnot. It enables me to, you know, a camera is access. A camera is access to people, access to places. So I've been always fascinated with that part of it. Mm-hmm. And then I decided, wow, well, I want to learn because there were no books. Like, it's at the time, internet has been, it's been dial up and it's, no information was available even in English. And then my English was nearly absent back then. So all the photographic theory has been inaccessible. So I decided to pick the next best thing, which was the moving image. So I decided to apply and got into the, applied for the director of photography department in the Karpenko Karov Institute in Kyiv, Ukraine. And I got in. And what it allowed me to do is it taught me how to see that place. So I was fortunate enough to study under some very, very interesting and just amazing cinematographers. Those were people the likes of Vittorio Storaro and Thierry Arbogast. Vittorio Storaro is the cinematographer of Francis Ford Coppola, and Thierry Arbogast and this Luc Besson's guy. So it was that level. So this was the creme de la creme of the Soviet cinema. Those lush, absolutely amazing visuals that come from Andrei Tarkovsky, from other people. So you see that stuff and I'm like, oh my God, I want to be able to create this. It became my passion. So this place, this cinematography department in Kyiv taught me how to see. But what I didn't realize back then is that it made me a very good tool in the hands of a director. Because the idea hasn't been mine. I have always been presented with the ideas like, okay, that's the script. This is what we're going to do. Now it's your job to make it look amazing. It's your job to make it look good. And back in the day, it was totally fine. But again, no cinema has been made in Ukraine in those days. Again, it was really rough times. So the only thing that's been available were newspapers. So I got introduced to someone, and then someone introduced me to someone else. And eventually I ended up freelancing and then being on staff in one of Kyiv's newspapers. So that's how I got into photojournalism, into documentary photography. And it was a really, really rough time for me because I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know how to do it, but like 12, 14 hour days nonstop, no weekends, no nothing. But again, it gave me the ability to produce a picture in any situation, a good picture in any situation with any equipment in any conditions. So
wow,
do the best you can with what you have in the time you've got where you are. And yeah, and I did, and I could. So essentially, the first 2 years of my studies were dedicated to still photography. We could not shoot anything vertical. We could not shoot anything diagonal. We could not experiment. The constraints were pretty strict. So wow. The frame could only be horizontal. Why? Because you cannot tilt the cinema camera like that. You cannot do all these things. There was no ability to use a movie camera, a cinema camera, as a still camera. So those were the limits. And but again, whenever I tried to do something whenever I tried to experiment, I was shut down because, look, this is impossible with the current technology. This is impossible. The screen has to be horizontal. You have to do things this way, not that way. That's it. Do it. No discussion. And that was, again, fine with me because it was still a very good, very intense school that put me, that gave me the ability to compete with professional reporters who were in business for nearly decades. And suddenly I happened to be that youngster who, you know, picked up not the best camera and consistently brought back decent images. So that's how I just started in photojournalism. And then I started freelancing for the Associated Press and other wire agencies in Kyiv. And at some point I just realized that, if I want to do something else, because those were only breaking news, no stories, no nothing. And I have been always fascinated with National Geographic. I have always been fascinated with these kind of things. And then at some point, someone brought, I don't even remember what it was right now, but it was, of course, a book about Magnum.
Okay.
And that was it. I discovered the whole new part of photography. It hasn't been just photojournalism in the very narrow perspective, because for me, photojournalism is mostly breaking news. It's, you know, very short features. It's the wire. It's newspaper stuff. Yeah. And documentary photography for me personally is long-term projects, something that you dedicate a significant amount of time to. You get into it, you get personal, you get up close. And that's how I understood that I need to go further, I need to push harder. And I ended up, I worked two jobs. One of them was English language newspaper in Kyiv that used to be called Kyiv Post. I'm not sure what it is now, but I met a lot of Americans, and somehow it dropped off on me. I'm like, okay, so somehow everything has been traced back to New York. But it at that time it may as well could be traced to the moon, because New York was just as far for me personally. And again, we're talking 1999, 2000, 2001, something like that. And then 9/11 happened, and that was one very, very acute moment where I remember, like, everybody, everyone else who has been, you know, more or less conscious that day remembers where they were and what they did. I was in my newsroom scanning a film, deadlines, all that stuff, the hum, and then suddenly I see that half of newsroom just got quiet, like really quiet, and got behind the TV that's been turned into One Direction, and they're pretty serious, like quiet, very unusual. And I was like, guys, like, what the hell's going on? Are you like watching something again? What's up? And I walked over there, and as I, you know, when the moment I saw the screen, the second plane hit the second hit the World Trade Center, and it was like, oh shit, oh my god, is this really happening? Like, what is going on? And then I realized that this is serious. This is super serious. And something needs to be done about it, and what can be done about it and whatnot. And that kind of reinforced my decision to go to New York, because I wanted to be there. I wanted to see this. I wanted to go professionally, because in Kyiv, I realized that, you know, I either have to turn to commercial photography or to change, you know, my line of work entirely. I decided I'm not ready to do that. So I decided to go to New York. Long story short, I ended up in New York and started freelancing for Gamma Press back in the day.
Okay.
Yep. And first it was Gamma, and then I went to Eddie Adams' workshop, where I met a bunch of editors, and that's where I met Santiago Lyon, the former DP of Associated Press. And and the Eddie Adams, we had to do, were assigned to shoot something. So I went and I shot my assignment and brought it back, and I was awarded an internship at the Washington Post, which was huge at the time for me. And it's like,
wow.
Yeah. So I spent a week at the Washington Post. I was blown away, of course, by everything that I saw. And I want to do that. I want to be with these guys. I want to be, you know, I want to see, and I want to be the news before it happens.
Yeah.
Like that was this high that I knew at some point after working for a while in New York for AP and for the Times and whatnot. Like, I could show up for an event, and if publicists would give me, you know, hard time, it's like, you know what? I can just walk away from here, and your event didn't happen.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there was that. I have to say that it was a part of it. But then in the end, New York has been just a bigger version of Kyiv. Sure, the Fashion Week was New York Fashion Week. Sure, breaking news in New York were breaking news in New York. Sure, I saw Barack Obama, I saw Prince Charles, I saw like all these people. I photographed it, and it was like, oh my God, wow. Seriously, that was amazing. But in the end, those were breaking news that didn't really resonate with me. I wanted to do something interesting, something better, something bigger, something that I'd be really proud of. Not something that would survive the test of time. And that's how I understood that I need to go further. So the American forces were in the international coalition, ISAF, preparing for the push in Afghanistan. And I keep seeing the news from Afghanistan over and over and over and again. It's never ending war. And it's like, it just seemed impossible to me. Like, guys, seriously, I work in New York City right now. I live in New York City. I see, you know, all this awesomeness, all this grandeur, all this power that surrounds me. I look at the news and I'm in disbelief. How is it possible that the most powerful military force in the history of mankind cannot defeat a bunch of illiterate guys with flip-flops and AK-47s? Like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Like, how is this possible? And the more I thought about it, the more I was like, I want to go. I want to see. I wanted to leave my own mark. I wanted to get to the bottom of things. So eventually, after about 5 years in New York City, I decided to schedule a meeting with Santiago Lyon. And he was kind enough to accept and invited me over to the AP office. And it was just, I was blown away by the guy. Like, he had such a presence. And mm-hmm. when I saw this huge map of the world behind him with dots, you know, with push pins in every location where AP had a stringer or a bureau.
Oh, God.
I was like, my God. And then there was a separate map of Afghanistan. And that was something like, Santi, I want to go there. We had a, you know, an hour long conversation about all the particulars and why and what. And I ended up embedded with the 101st Airborne in Afghanistan. And that's how I fell down the rabbit hole that I entirely did not expect, because I went there in the hopes of finding answers. I came back with even more questions.
God.
No one knew what was going on, how it was going on, how, like, again, I saw F-16s flying overhead. You get to Bagram Airfield, you get to any American base out there, you just suddenly, and I wore a uniform without insignia, but still it was somehow better, helped me blend in, and soldiers perceived me as, you know, a little bit closer. So I felt myself like a part of this absolutely unstoppable force, that there is nothing in this world that's capable of stopping us. I mean, come on, United States Army, what can you do? And yet somehow, as time went by, I was like, so what are we doing here? Why is it happening the way it does? Why nearly every American base in Afghanistan is located in the old location of the Soviet base? Why I constantly see the remnants of the Soviet invasion, and Americans is essentially doing the very same thing. So what's going on? How is it even possible that we cannot tackle this problem? This became the longest running war in American history, and no one had the answers. No, not my platoon sergeant, not Stanley McChrystal, and every shade in between. Like, all my questions, you know, went unanswered. And the Afghans, there wasn't really a way to communicate with them. But it was a really, really eerie feeling when we went on patrols. And at some point, so the lieutenant that I was embedded with, of the platoon that I was embedded with, he needed to talk to an elder in some village on the Pakistani border or something. And the soldiers secured the perimeter, and they started talking, whatnot. And I'm just walking around with the camera, like, taking pictures, you know, doing my thing. Because I had to file for AP every day, I was there to produce pictures. So I got busy. But then at some point, the elder just completely breaks away from the American that he was talking to, and it turns to me, and it's like, Shuravi, which means Russian in Pashto. And I was blown away, because, like, I'm Ukrainian, and I would like to emphasize it that I'm Ukrainian, and I speak Russian, not because I chose to. For me, it's a language of Cortez. Latin America speaks Spanish not because it chose to. So same goes here. Yeah. Anyway, but for any foreigner, for anyone who is not familiar with the peculiarities, I looked very Slavic, and it was just so bizarre, because the guy was holding an old AK-47 that was just polished from decades of constant wear, and the paint was somewhere there, but it was just shiny. It was nearly silver. And I understood, and I look at the guy, and then I ask the lieutenant, what's going on and who is this person? I understand that this is the former Mujahideen commander that fought Soviet forces. And he recognized me because of my Slavic face, that, like, okay, yeah, you look familiar. And I understand that he got his AK-47 from probably dead Soviet soldier. And it just, oh my God, it became much more than an assignment. And what started as a purely documentary pursuit evolved into my personal catharsis, for which this war became just a background. So, buyers. Two mentalities, same battlefield, 12 years apart. That's something that forced me to ask a lot of uncomfortable questions for myself. And that's how unknowingly I started to work on my book. So eventually, during the creation of this book, as I shot it, as I went through my torments and, you know, my questions and all of that psychological trauma and experience of being there and not being there at the same time, I learned things about myself that I did not expect completely. And I found answers to questions that I didn't know had to be asked.
It's an amazing experience. I mean, what was it like mentally preparing to go across then? Was you just literally excited?
I was excited and scared at the same time. Anyone who says that he isn't scared is either stupid or lying or both.
Yeah.
Of course it's scary. Of course it takes, why special forces, why SAS and our guys, why they train constantly? Because it has to be muscle memory. When you get into such a stressful situation and your life is on the line, you don't think. It's reaction. So, without this training, without this stuff, it was pretty difficult. AP said that I had to go through the hostile environment training provided by the Centurion, actually a British company. Nice guys, former British soldiers.
Okay.
Nice folks. So they created a situation similar to what I could get into, like what's it like to be taken hostage? What's it like when there is a, you know, when you step on a landmine? What's it like if someone else steps on a landmine? All these scenarios were played out, but nothing could prepare me for the real thing. Because when you see things happening in front of your eyes, when you see, well, I was talking to a guy just, you know, chilling at the base and whatnot. But, you know, where are you from? Married? No kids? No? Yes? No? That kind of stuff. What are you into? You like football? You like baseball? Well, you know, you get to know people slowly. And so we go on patrol. We ride in the truck. And then, you know, his truck gets blown up. And that's it. And that's the experience that you go through. That's why soldiers don't like to talk about it.
Yeah.
And it's such a hard psychological damage. Even if you yourself don't get hurt, you see things, you experience things, and you know, something that really, really, really pushed me over the edge was that I was told to bring back the visual equivalent of Apocalypse Now, because that's what the public expects. That's something that we all want to see, because we all grew up watching Apocalypse Now, The Platoon, you know, other movies about war, where it's all visual, with all explosions, it's all very, you know, interesting, very, very colorful, very impressive. You know, the Soviet legacy has always, the Soviet propaganda has always influenced heavily, all the heroics, all that stuff. Reality couldn't be further from the truth. The reality could not be further from what I was expecting.
Yeah.
Because I was told that I need to bring back action, you know, soldiers shooting, engaging, all of that, you know, either destruction or peace building. We're either bad, we're either fighting bad guys or we're helping good guys. That's it. Nothing in between.
Yeah.
But all that action turned out to be 15%, and I'm being generous now, of the entire time that I saw there and of the entire war. Only 15 to 20%. And again, I'm being generous here. Everything else is just boredom. You bored out of your mind. you're scared, you're anxious, you don't know what's coming. You just sit there for hours and hours and hours and then not knowing where's the mortar going to come from. You know, is someone watching you? Like you walk out, you take a piss somewhere, and you kind of conscious about this stuff. And that's something that gives you PTSD. This is something that it doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't happen like it. But when I came back to New York, at some point I was afraid to step on the grass. Like I caught myself on that. Like this is bad. Like this is bad. Yeah. I caught myself like shit. So. Yeah, it's those things, and it affects you. You can't just leave the war and come back like nothing ever happened.
So, I mean, I've interviewed a few people that served as military photographers, and they've one of them's actually doing a charity for things like PTSD, because they don't like talking about it because obviously they're big macho men and they have this sort of stigma. But, you know, he spoke a little bit and said, you know, it was a big thing to suddenly come out of a war environment and then just become a civilian, like a civilian photographer sort of thing. So I can't imagine it.
Well, what I would like to address right now is that all that macho thing, oh, we're so tough, we're so cool, we're like, fuck that shit, seriously. We're allowed to have our emotions. We're allowed to feel shitty. We're allowed to be ourselves. And the society, you know, we grew up traumatized by our parents, and our parents are traumatized by their parents. And... Yeah. You know, all the societal pressures that as a man, you're supposed to be this, as a woman, you're supposed to be that. And if you don't fit the cliche, you bear the wrath of public opinion.
Opinion and popularity. Yeah.
Yeah. So how is it possible that you don't fit the cliche? Are you not a real man or what?
Yeah.
But, you know, war teaches me, what taught me a couple of things. And first and foremost is to value life, every single moment of it. Yeah. I was enjoying beer like there is no tomorrow. I was enjoying women like it's the last day of my life. I was enjoying having good time with my friends. I went to raves. I did all of these things, and it felt so sharp. It felt so acute. It was like, oh my God, this could have been the last day. And what separates, you know, the biggest difference between people who were there and who weren't is that those who were understand, and those who weren't never, because there is nothing in civilian lives that prepares you for what you see and what you experience. So I would say that it's very important that we discuss issues like that. It's very important that we hold our politicians accountable that. Because some guy who wears suit in Washington, D.C. may never saw a day of combat, decides that it's a good idea to invade Iraq. Or it's a good idea to go somewhere else. But it's not him who's fighting. It's not him who pays the price. And the financial cost of war, the mental cost of war, the human cost of war in terms of losses and, you know, killed, wounded, all that stuff is absolutely insane. And what did we get out of it? We got Bin Laden, but That's why Americans went to Afghanistan, and Americans wanted to stabilize the country so it doesn't become a breeding ground for terrorists. We got bin Laden. That's it. But September 11th of this year, Biden said that America is going to pull out completely and the country is going to fall back to Taliban. They will start killing people on streets and, you know, everything goes back to normal. So how? Why is this happening? The biggest question that we need to ask ourselves is that why are we doing things the way we do? And I had a very, very big problem dealing with this stuff. Because on one hand, I saw that my assignment was go there, do all these, create those amazing images, because the publications need it, because the people need it, but then it creates this vicious circle when the media produces what people like, what people consume, and people consume what media produces. That's it. That's a set story. That's the set truth of it. And another thing that I'd like to mention when we talk about the tech industry in general, and not just the tech industry, but specifically tech, because these guys wield an insane power over the rest of the population, over the rest of us, because we are glued to our phones. We basically become prisoners of that rectangle in our hands. And the only goal of the people on the other side is to make money. They don't think about the impact. They don't think how, you know, what happens to people who actually use the product and whatnot. So this is why I think that at some point there's going to be either a moment of reckoning or just going to be something's going to happen. So at some point we need to ask ourselves why we do what we do. Is it actually good? You can't measure everything. Like, money cannot be the only common denominator for everyone.
It can't work. I think you're right. I don't think it'll be our generation. I think it's going to take another generation to make these changes. And I recently saw about Facebook, for instance, wanting to do a kids version for like 7 to 14-year-olds or whatever it is. And it's like, well, you can see, can't you? Because that's profitable, because they're already getting in for the future. And it's like, no, I do not want my 9 and 10-year-old looking at Facebook and getting addicted, and their life has to be now. Because, like, for instance, I noticed this, that let's say I've been out today somewhere for the seaside with my family. The whole pressure is, oh, what have you done today? Let's get my photo up. And it's like, no. So like at the weekend, we did a day out. I met a friend. I put nothing up on social media. I shot film on purpose because I might get them developed next month. I might get them developed next year. And I'll have that memory because it's for me and my family.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
What's good about social, you know, it fell into a very unfortunate position, because on one hand, everybody got a camera in their phones, in their pockets, and but understanding of what it means, understand that nobody asks themselves, like, why we're doing what we do. Nobody reads, nobody educates themselves on, okay, so I take this picture, I post it, what's next? What's it going to be? Like, am I going to get a lot of, what's the purpose of it? And is it just for likes? Or is there something better? Is there something bigger?
Yeah.
So, and I mean, we can expand this far and wide, but I'm sure you have something else to say and ask.
No, I think you're right. And it is going to change because AI is now catching up, isn't it? So, for instance, me and my mates were talking about it, and he said, have you seen or tried Skylum software? Have you seen it? Right, okay. So it's a software that basically can pick out things. Let's say you left a leg in and you didn't want a leg in, it could see that, or a tree in the background, and it can change backgrounds and skies and stuff, and it can do it all for you. And it's literally, you know, quite revolutionary in that sense. And, you know, I just see it as the end of photography in that sense, because it's like, for me, photography is about what I see and how I create it, not someone else doing things too much for me. But it's a tough one.
Well, it's evolution.
Yeah,
it's evolution, and I would say that we need to talk more about it. There needs to be a public discussion. Like people need to bring it up and ask themselves this question. Mm-hmm. So again, we need to understand that a classic photo, a baseline needs to be established, and that baseline mm-hmm. says that what we see on the picture, be it framed work in a gallery or somewhere on a screen, is a certain moment in time captured by a certain person, framed by a certain camera and a certain light with a certain lens and a certain shutter speed and exposure and yada, 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 all of this stuff. Okay. And nothing more. Because the moment mm-hmm. you choose to frame it, the moment you choose to something include or exclude from the image, you alter that reality. So it's subjective by definition. So at this point, yeah, I think documentary photography needs to ask itself a lot of hard questions. Like, where do we stand technically? Where do we stand theoretically? Where do we stand as professionals? Because honestly, the only arbiter of truth is the guy with the camera, or a guy with a laptop that you actually trust.
Yeah.
And you need to understand as a professional that if you are a documentarian, if you're a journalist, people's life literally depend on what you do. And that's a very, very, very important question. This is the most important question there is.
So, well, because what you're showing from Afghanistan, it is important, because you could show something very different, because you could choose to only show certain things in certain light. And I don't just mean the sun, you know, the situations that's happened over there that you photographed, and, you know, that they show a car blowing up, and it's like you say, but that's only a small part of it, isn't it?
Yeah, but again, my story in Afghanistan, I would like to repeat myself that it started as a purely documentary pursuit and evolved into my own personal catharsis, for which this war became just a background. So nothing you see on the image is actually really what it is. And it's my own dark fairy tale filled with my fears and dreams and issues and whatnot, set on the set against the background of what has become the longest war in American history. So it's my way, it's my story, it's my thing. It's not a documentary project, it's an art project, and this is something that needs to be defined very in bold letters right up top. I don't claim to be like, this is not a documentary project.
Yeah.
So this is very important. And once we establish that, then we can dig into the fact that I went there to find certain answers. Instead, I ended up with more questions than answers. Like, why I wanted to be a war photographer? Why I want to damage myself by being there? Why am I so obsessed with the army? Why I want to do this, and why I want to come back? and why I need and want people to see it, why I think this conversation is important. So there is this gigantic why out there that essentially precedes any conversation about my work in Afghanistan. And those are not simple questions, and those are hard questions. So whenever I see guys with cameras who want to go to war and be freelancers and stringers and whatnot, I'm like, why you want to go there? Because it's hot, because it's a really cool topic in a bar, it's gonna get your female attention, or is it, you know, I mean, those are fair questions to ask. Or you actually care about the situation, or you actually care about the people, because you do care about the people. And if you care about the situation, maybe, just maybe, there is a better way to apply yourself. Maybe you could go and volunteer with Doctors Without Borders. Maybe you can do something with the Red Cross. Maybe I'm just throwing it out there. So those are fundamental issues that need to be addressed before we grab a camera and just like, oh my God, look at my picture from Aleppo. Who gives a fuck? You get paid $70. So what?
Yeah. No, I mean, how long was you over there in the end then?
What's that?
How long was you over there?
I was in Afghanistan for about 6 months total. I spent there summer of 2009 and 2011.
Yeah, so that's a long time. And was that with the same airborne unit all the time?
No, those are different units. Basically, there's another interesting thing. The Army, knowing that it takes about, 3 weeks to break the mental animosity between the soldiers and the press and members of the press, because, yes, there is this natural animosity. Like, again, journalists were being stupid in the beginning, like really stupid. People were complaining about, oh my God, the firefights, those guys cursed, and they did this and they did that. When you are in the firefight and you're shooting an enemy and everything is chaotic and shrapnel flies and your friends are being killed somewhere, you tend to say fuck once in a while.
Yeah.
And when you're being portrayed in the media as this bad guy who just went there to do something, and like, really, did you ever leave your newsroom? Do you ever go anywhere but Starbucks and see reality, like the real life? What's it like to be there? How can you possibly write this shit? Then the superiors in the army see those articles like, oh, this is bad. This is portrays us in a bad light. And then the guys on the ground, the soldiers get penalized for that. And I'm like, yeah, world is not black and white. Everything is shade of gray.
And consequences, like you were saying, isn't it, to what you're choosing to shoot and show everyone.
Yep, absolutely. It's a three-dimensional puzzle that you move one piece and then the entire structure starts to shake. So again, it all boils down to education. If you lack the ability to critically think, to thinking critically, that's a big trouble, because without asking yourself those questions, how can you actually give any answers to anyone? Starting with yourself. So that's why I decided to do, like, I, there is no subjectivity. I cannot be that fly on the wall in Afghanistan or anywhere else. Like, the best thing that I can hope for is to be honest. And I should probably start with myself and start asking myself all those questions. And that's why I understood that I have to leave journalism, because there is no place for me there. Like, I do not subscribe to this dogma. I do not want to be tooled someone else's hands. And I don't want to give them the picture that they want, that they like. I want to figure out my own issues. I want to understand myself. I want to have an honest dialogue with the mirror. And that's how I ended up with this body of work. I did it uncompromisingly. I did it the way I wanted to, and I used the tools that I wanted to. And yes, regardless of the situation now, and regardless of my stance of on you know, various industries and whatnot, I have to thank Apple for building an iPhone, because it was a very transformative tool for me. I have to thank Hipstamatic that they built their application, because the way this book, the Inshallah, came to life was that it was a very strange experience for me. So after I came back from Afghanistan in 2009, I understood that something must change immediately. I do not want to do what I do and do it how I do it. Mm-hmm. So I decided to apply to an art school, and I got into a bunch of good schools here in the States, and I decided to go to Rhode Island School of Design. I wouldn't say that this is necessarily the best choice, but back in the day, it seemed like a very interdisciplinary and interesting place where I could meet many people and, you know, have this cross-pollination happen and, you know, bring my knowledge and absorb theirs and whatnot.
Yeah.
So it was a very, very challenging year for me. The first year of my master's degree at RISD. And then I realized that I don't fit in. I painfully don't fit in. And the only place where I wanted to go, I didn't want to go back to New York, where, you know, my family was, where I, you know, my friends were. I wanted to go to the only place where I felt comfortable, which was Afghanistan. So I decided to go again, and I again went there in 2011. And at that point, I was producing the same beautiful, perfectly composed, sharp, colorful images that grace the cover of any magazine, any newspaper, any book. But those were like, you know, I felt cold. Those images felt cold. They felt impersonal. They felt empty. They felt like models on cover of glossy magazines. Like, you know that it's not real. Mm-hmm. So at some point, there was a moment when I was tormented. I couldn't sleep. I didn't know what to do with myself. So I decided to, soldiers were actually asking me to, hey, take a picture of me with a big gun and a cigar clenched in my teeth. Sure, no problem. And then at some point, I realized that one file from 5D Mark II was like 25 megabytes, and I quickly ran out of space, and then it was a hassle for the guys because a huge file. Why? So I just pulled out my phone, snap a picture, and give it to them immediately. And they're like, oh, wow, that's cool. That's awesome. So at some point, I needed to free up some space in my phone, and I downloaded everything on my laptop. And in Photomechanic, I opened two contact sheets. On one was were the images that I shot with the professional camera, and then the other one were the images that I shot with the phone. And that was the epiphany moment. That was the moment that I understood that I'm, you know, this is critical. This is really, really important. As I said, the images on the left were colorful, ideally composed, but cold. It felt impersonal. And the images on the right were pictures that I shot for myself without thinking of editors, without thinking of readers, without thinking of anyone else who could, judge me in any way, shape, or form. And they were warm. They were alive. They were personal. So that's what happened during that moment. And I understood that this is it. I should start shooting with the phone, because even though I know that it's a phone, I know it's a camera, somehow when I was shooting with the phone, mentally, psychologically, it was easier for me. I felt free. I felt no obligations. I was just being myself, unplugged. And I started shooting left and right with a phone, and I ended up with more than 1,000 of images. When I came back to school, I again, I printed all of my work from 2009, the color images that I've done for EP, and I laid them out on the floor of my studio. And I just kept staring at them, not knowing what to do, pulling my hair, trying to figure out what's like, yeah. But then I realized, like, look, what if I could go there again? I couldn't go there again because the school, because of other constraints and whatnot. So what I did is at some point I was just, you know, not knowing what to do and struggling. And I just pulled out my phone as I saw a fragment on the picture that was laying on the floor. I saw a certain fragment that I felt interesting. I opened my phone. I opened Hipstamatic, and I framed that specific square that was interesting. And when I snapped the image and it popped up on the screen of my phone, there was another epiphany because I was able to make this work mine again.
Okay.
So I re-photographed a whole bunch of images from the first trip, and altogether it gave me enough material. A professor in the graphic design department of the school said that he wants to produce a book with me. That was one of those moments when I realized, oh my God, wow, this is this is real. This is happening. Like I didn't expect to publish a book, let alone monograph, anytime soon. But it did happen. It actually like put a seed in my head. Like, whoa. The guy is actually serious. This is not some student. This is a very well-respected professor at my school. So we started to work on this project. And eventually, after graduation, I let this work sit for about a year. And just not looking at it, I needed a break. And then I decided to find... I was really impressed with the work of Toyn Wonderheiden, a Dutch designer who worked with a whole bunch of documentarians, including Donald Weber, Kadine van Luzen, a whole bunch of other people, Stanley Green, whatnot. So I shot him an email and he said, yep, let's do this. And I came to Amsterdam and we spent 3 days working on the layout. And I'm not sure if you have seen the book itself, but I was very pleased with the result.
Oh, that's nice, though, isn't it? Must give you that nice feeling of like accomplishing something that you probably didn't realize you were doing.
Strangely enough, it felt very anticlimactic because I spent with this work so much time. You know, at some point when you stare at these images days and months and years on end, and just becomes a maze. You just don't, it becomes a blur. I couldn't actually push the work further to get from it what I wanted. So I needed a break. And eventually work with a very good editor helped me to actually find the specific tone that I wanted to convey. And I was very pleased with the results. And the book has been published by Kara Verlag in Germany in 2015.
Oh, that's good. No, I mean, that's really interesting. Well, I think we're through the formal part of the interview there, Dima, so I can't thank you enough for that. Do you want to tell everybody where we can check out your book and your social media, et cetera, as well?
Well, when it comes to social media, I don't post any of my professional work out there. It's just Instagram for my daily experiences, and it's nothing special. But the book is available on Amazon, and sure, I'd be delighted if people wanted to check it out and ask me more questions, because that's what the whole thing is about.
Yeah, no, that's cool. So I'll put a link in the show notes for you so people can find that. And then my final question for you is, have you got anyone that you would recommend work I check out or maybe even be interested in coming on the show at some point?
Well, I highly recommend checking out Pedro Letria. my classmate okay. from school. He's an amazing photographer, and he's the guy who works in a very interesting way. He combines images and text, but his way of doing that just blows me away, because he writes a very eloquent, beautiful English, and he combines those texts with photographs. And when you combine those two mediums, you get something else. You get a third dimension. You get something that, you know, the text supports the image and image supports the text, and they amplify each other to the point of creating something entirely different. And I'm a huge fan of him and his work. I highly recommend checking him out.
No, that sounds really cool, actually. Yeah. Are you all right to send me a link to it?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's cool. So thank you for coming on, Dima. It's really nice to get to know you and learn about your times over there. I think it's important work, and I think that's why you're so enthusiastic, and that's great.
Awesome. Thank you so much. There are a couple of things that I wanted to mention. Also, not sure if it's like if we're done, we're done. But basically what I wanted to also mention is that the school, the education. So when the first school taught me how to see, the second school taught me how to think. And very important aspect was that not the medium dictates the idea, but the idea dictates the medium. And ever since, now in my portfolio, I have data visualization, the diagram that you mentioned in the email. That was actually American military strategy in Afghanistan. It's appropriated imagery from the declassified document, official document.
Okay.
And I have video installation. And now, actually, what I'd really like to do is to expand beyond photography, because one of the projects that I'm really looking for forward to doing is having this coin refers to counterinsurgency diagram that you see on my website. Yeah. I would like to take that PowerPoint slide and weave it into traditional Afghan carpet. Because conceptually, conceptually, I think that is a beautiful and most eloquent commentary on what's going on out there and how these two cultures can coexist. So that's another very important aspect of my work and what I do. And maybe some of your listeners would be receptive to the idea, and maybe we can get together, like create a conversational club, for example. We can schedule, a call or something where people are willing to ask questions, to share ideas, to think, to talk, because this is the only way to move forward. And one last thing that I'd like to add is read. If your work isn't good enough, you aren't reading enough. That's one last thing that I'd like to add, because that's it.
No, that's cool. No, I totally agree. I keep coming across work. I read when I'm not too tired after work.
I'm not referring to you specifically. I'm just...
Oh, no. No, I understand the inventory. But, you know, we're here to help influence people in the right ways as well, aren't we?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. And, you know, my voice is no different to yours. All our voices are important. So if we do our little bits to encourage people, and especially where you're in situations like you've said in America where you're not happy with things, and you're not the only one. A lot of the artists I've spoke to are all exactly the same as you. There was a lot of things we couldn't say several months ago, shall we say, because you don't know what might happen. Now things are different, so hopefully they'll change.
Hopefully.
We just got to keep pushing.
Yeah. Sure. I would say sure, let's keep pushing, but at some point you just want to stop and stand back a little bit and chill and like, you know what, maybe it's enough. The whole purpose of life is not to keep pushing constantly. Sometimes you need you need a break. You need to stop. Mm-hmm. You need to think. You need to look back. You need to reflect. And that's something that's been missing from the conversation a lot of times.
Yeah. You're right. Yeah, reflection is everything. I think the same. Because if you never stop to think, then what are you doing?
Yeah.
I can't thank you enough, Timo. It was really appreciated.
Thank you. Thank you for doing this. That's a really interesting hobby you got. And let's hope that it turns more people into photography and brings men to thinking more. So.
Yeah. Critical thinkers. That's what we want.
All right.
I'll always remember that.
And thanks for the call.
No problem. Thanks a lot, Dima. Hey, I just wanted to say thank you so much for listening to that episode. I hope you enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed interviewing. Please don't forget, if you want to get involved, I'm starting to put out there on social media the list of guests for that week. You are welcome to submit any questions you want to ask, and hopefully I'll read them out for you. Whether you want to do that through Instagram, direct message, you can just click, if you click on the direct message bit, there's a button there and you can record and send that right across. But there's many apps you can do, or email me, or send me a DM on Facebook, Instagram, whatever. That's cool with me. For those of you who want to support the show, please don't forget, iTunes reviews are always appreciated. And obviously I will read them out the following week for you. And I tend to use them on social media, so that's all very much appreciated. If you'd like to help contribute towards the show, then don't forget there's my Ko-fi page where you can submit anything from $1, pounds or upwards, and I'll keep a note on there what I'm trying to achieve as the months and years go by. For those who want to keep coming back to the show, don't forget you can just subscribe in your friendly podcast app of choice, and there's a weekly newsletter on my website, flogger.co.uk, so that's PHLOGGER, and you'll get an automated email from me, and that tells you each week what's gone up on the website. So it's the podcasts and any articles I've wrote. So yeah, thank you so much, and I'll see you again soon. Bye.